Welcome to Dread, Fright, and Brew, where your favorite horror movies are paired with craft brews and ciders from the Pacific Northwest and beyond. Your hosts this evening are Aaron Hatfield, Grace Schrick, and Lee Despain. Fear goes better with beer.
He's a good little actor, but
Jesus, I've wanted to see if he's in anything else, but I never think about it, because when I think about, like, hey, I wonder really what I'm going to watch today, I'm not like, oh, something with the fucking kid from Babadook. All right, well, we'll just have to figure out these here levels as we go, but it's looking like everything's really low again.
Yeah. So you got through the...
That went off the charts. That was good.
Checking was your good. Sound levels.
Check, check, test, test, check, test, test. Testing.
Just a little brap in there.
You got through that buzzing sound, though, that was on my mic?
Yeah, whatever. Just a nightmare. Whatever it was, with.
You should probably stop licking the microphone.
Shut
up. The problem of it was that I could hear it going through everything. So I had to, like, mute, you know, different channels and solo different
Hands
channels until I finally found out, okay, it's that mic. But the problem is that if one of us isn't talking, someone else is.
It's me stroking my magnificent beard.
So you're stroking something. That didn't get picked up, but I do know that you scratched your arm 7 times.
Serious?
Oh, because it's so, like,
that's fucking hilarious.
I know, this is fun. So I've got a new game. Let's see how many things we can throw in that noise wise that Aaron has to get annoyed with while he's editing the podcast.
Totally. We'll just pick a number and see how many he can find.
If you guys don't mind coming back tomorrow to re-record it, that's totally fine by me.
<We're> like, well, hold on now. Is there more beer?
This is all
it's
dark
out of stock. Right,
I mean,
now.
If we come back tomorrow,
out of stock meaning. They don't make it at this time of year, because that's going to bum me out, because we're telling people to go find it.
Or no, I think our distributor's just out at the moment.
Perfect. All right. That's what I want to hear.
Well, let's do this thing then, I guess, huh?
We probably should.
Yeah. I think we already got a lot of fun stuff going.
Definitely. I'm not sure if there's a segue anywhere in there, but
we'll find one.
We'll try to find
one. Oh, I think there's good shit.
Were we recording all that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been recording for like 5.5 minutes. Yeah. Something like that. Surprise, everybody. We're recording.
Surprise!
That nice belch in there?
It is. It is recorded. Nice. It's on tape.
Yeah. You can really muffle them a little bit if I know it's recording.
I think I'm going to work that into the intro somehow.
Nice.
We'll just make that burp an official part of the program.
Unless that was the part where you said, oh, why isn't this recording? And then you hit record. That might have been after.
No, it's on there.
Is it?
Good. We got it.
Good.
So, here it is.
Yeah. Welcome.
What is it now? Episode 3?
3.
Good grief. We've lost track already. We've been doing this for so long, I can't even keep track anymore. Two was just, you know, the void.
The void.
Oh, shit. Yes. We just did that, too.
Yeah, we've gotten to 3, and we haven't killed each other yet.
Mm-mm.
No promises.
Yeah. Well, they say third time's a charm, so I don't know what we didn't accomplish in the first two that is going to be great this time. But apparently, as that saying goes, something.
Well, I mean, my goal is just to not sound so much like an idiot. It's going to be a long...
So we should just wrap. So that's it. All right. That's episode 3. You didn't sound like an idiot. We're out.
Peace.
No, we got to do this thing because I'm excited.
Yeah,
I'm
too.
Super, super excited to talk about Babadook.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite movies.
Babadook so on the... What the fuck? The rails. And we've got Dark Truth.
Dark Truth. The beer. From Boulevard.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Let's crack that fucker open.
Yeah. Yeah, we're what?
So
like a couple minutes into this and no beer
mine.
Yet?
Yeah.
That's fair. You gotta reload that belch machine you got going on there.
Don't judge me.
Who can belch on command?
Not I. Never been a skill.
I can.
Really?
That's
Are
good.
We gonna do Just this?
So 30 seconds ago, he said his plan was to not sound.
Okay,
and she just said she's a lady, and then that. I got nothing for you guys. I actually put my Diet Dr. Pepper away early.
So that this shit wouldn't
happen.
And
said, I've got to stop drinking soda so I don't belch all the way through this episode. Apparently, I should not have worried about it.
No, this podcast
is
people.
It's a beer podcast.
This podcast is peopled entirely
too,
by liars,
English
apparently.
In English and in French, yes. But I'm not drunk enough for that.
I
saw that.
Apparently feel bad that I can't belch on command and...
Wait.
I am just a little bit.
I was waiting for
you.
I got
Here
something.
It comes. Oh, look. Shit.
Check this mug out. Check this fucker out.
Why
Eventually,
do you have so many shenanigans mugs?
We're going to have to start live streaming these or something because the things people miss seeing.
Oh, no, that's flavor.
So Lee has pulled out his mug for this episode. We decided last episode that something that was going to happen going forward was that Lee was going to drink from a different vessel each podcast.
Because apparently has a plethora of shenanigans.
This thing is amazing. Is we have to put a picture of this on Facebook or something.
Oh, okay. And let it's heavy see this. Too, isn't it? That surprised the shit out of me when I first got it.
So we'll get a picture of this and put it online so that you guys can see this thing. But this is really cool. It's a skull wearing a medieval helmet with horns that remind me very much of, and I don't know his name, but the bad dude in Willow.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
He's got kind of curved Viking guy? Helmet that comes back towards the face, kind of like Frank Frazetta's Death Dealer.
Put Viking like helmet and horns in the same sentence.
No, well, I mean, okay, horns.
Oh, Grace is giving me the eye because Grace thinks that Viking helmets should have horns.
No, I'm just watching the fight. I think it's
Viking
funny.
Viking horns were not part of their battle wear, but they did have them ceremonially.
I've never heard such a thing.
That's true. But check this shit out, man. The fucker just comes loose for cleaning.
Wow. It has a liner.
I obviously haven't done that liner. In a while.
Oh, well, put some beer in that thing so you can start
drinking. Well, if he stops groping it, I will.
That thing is pretty awesome. I do want to put a picture of that online because that thing is really cool.
I
want
to know the Willow guy's name. It's going to bug the shit out of me.
I don't know. We'll have to find that out. I have a computer device. I'll look it up here in a little bit.
Yes. Right on.
So what did we just pour for ourselves, Grace? Take us on a trip.
Boulevard Dark Truth Imperial Stout. So Boulevard Brewing started in 1984. John McDonald, who was a carpenter by trade, started homebrewing after some inspiration. He was hanging out in Europe, fell in love with Belgian beers, started homebrewing, ended up selling his house to raise money to open his own brewery, moved his carpentry shop, built a brewery, took over a year to actually open it. When he first opened it, included a vintage 35-barrel Bavarian brew house. So he did everything. He was in love with European beers.
Fair enough.
And he wanted to bring that to America. So that was kind of his whole mission. So November of 1989, his first keg, which was Boulevard Pale Ale, was delivered to a nearby restaurant. And it kind of just took off from there. His goal originally was to do 6,000 barrels a year. By 2004, he was doing 100,000 barrels a year. So he's
so he did
all right.
All right.
Yeah. He's doing all right. He kind of figured out.
He picked up a trick or two.
Right.
Yeah.
2006, $25 million expansion to 150 barrel brew house, packaging system, offices, whole shebang. Like redid his entire
brewery. Good grief.
And then recently, I didn't look up the date. A couple years back, these guys actually sold, not to like the evil empire.
Which one?
Well, that's fair.
Yeah.
Duvel Mortgat portfolio. So Michel Mortgat, the president, approached John and offered to buy them, basically. And John, who was actually originally inspired by Duvel, was totally on board with that. So now they're a part of that Mortgat portfolio and have more global distribution and all of this kind of fun, cool stuff. And they're part of that. And Duvel Mortgat, that portfolio is all a bunch of kind of smallish specialty breweries that are just kind of all lumped together for
definitely
different reasons. But
yeah, Omegang got picked up, Firestone Walker a year after these guys. I was actually looking into just that whole, I don't know, the fallout of that, because I'm always fascinated when a brewery that has a lot going for it decides to let itself be purchased. And so I wanted to at least look into kind of the ramifications. And they didn't suffer as much backlash outside of Missouri and kind of their area as you would think. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way that Duvel runs the breweries that they purchase.
Exactly.
Because they leave the brewing staff intact. They leave the decision-making intact. Mm-hmm. They still choose what beers they want to make. They still get to choose when and how.
Yeah, they're still making the same great beers.
Total control. Duvel just says, let us help you out with distribution. Let us get you into Europe. And I guess for some of these folks, like, Duvel had great West Coast coverage.
Yeah.
But these guys did not. Or maybe it was the opposite of that. But regardless, when they came together, it helped them both out to where just it has expanded the reach. I think these guys are in like 29 states.
Yeah, it's crazy.
For Boulevard now.
And I think, I think a lot of it has to do with who bought them.
Totally.
Because, I mean, there's a lot of tension in the brewing world about buyouts and
sure.
being a sellout and all of that stuff. You know, it's this is completely different from if how a brewery is treated if they sell to Anheuser.
Yeah.
If AB buys you, you're making a deal with the devil as far as craft beer is concerned.
Sure. And even then, though, I have noticed there are...
But some get scorned.
Yeah, I was going to say, a little harder than others.
Like 10 Barrel got torn apart.
10 Barrel was reamed.
But nobody gave a shit when Elysian did it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And Hop Valley had like a week of screw you, we're done with you, we're not drinking your beer ever again. And then I've never heard a peep. Some of these, you know, brewers and breweries make fantastic beers, get purchased, and then people literally just stop buying.
Which they shouldn't, because big breweries are getting smart now. And they're saying, $10 billion industry, something like that. And craft brews only account for, 3 or 4%? Mm-hmm. So they're like, 3 or 4% of $10 billion is still $10 billion.
A lot of money.
Still 4% of that. So they're like, we need to get into that, but we can't change it.
Totally.
And I think that's where the elitist attitude comes from. It's like, oh, no, they belong to the evil conglomeration, but they're not really changing anything. They're still saying, hey, man, do your thing, man, because it's what people love.
Well, I'm on par with a certain amount of rejection of anything that's owned by big beer, and probably more than not. Mm-hmm. That I'm completely okay with. But it doesn't have to do with not supporting that brewer anymore, or that brewery, or that local community where they might have been located, that, you know, needs those dollars to pour in and those jobs to be kept. For me, it's more of when this big beer business is buying up all the hops that are available, not leaving anything for the little guys to produce beer. Exactly. South Africa. It has to do more when the distributors that distribute the AB products are then forcing beer buyers to give them a certain X square footage of your space, or you can't buy our beers anymore, which unfortunately, when big beer is still the lion's share of the beer market nationwide, you can't do. You can't be, I mean, you're a beer buyer, Grace. You couldn't not have some of those beers.
No.
Because so many people still want that stuff.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is there's this fine line between supporting the brewers and supporting the, you know, the house that owns them. So it gets interesting. So far, quality hasn't gone down on some of them, but eventually things go downhill. Ingredients get swapped out. Choices get made for them. And it's frustrating because, I mean, especially in Portland, we're all about, you know, let's support these little guys. Let's support this creative industry that we're a huge part of. We're a leader in this, you know. And then if we have a local guy go down, is basically how we look at it. It's huge. And if I had to, you know, luckily where I'm at, as far as buying, I don't have to designate a certain amount of space to certain distributors and things like that. It's totally my call. But I also have to play the game.
The beer is cooled down a bit or warmed up. Warmed up for a bit you folk.
Yeah. It was too cold, so yeah, now it's pretty good.
I will tell you something. So this is our second episode in a row where we've done an Imperial Stout. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They could not be more different.
Oh, I know.
Could not be more different. The fact that he uses a Belgian influence on this and a Belgian yeast.
Yep.
The yeast is all, people talk about hops, they talk about malts and barley. And yeah, sure, the big part of it. Man, that yeast is your foundation.
And it plummy, is huge. Fruity goodness from that yeast, and it makes me happy.
Yeah. That was my notes that I have here is fruity, sweet, and spicy. There is that little bit of spiciness that comes through, and I'm thinking that's coming from yeast.
It could be the yeast. It also could be a little bit from the hops, because this is going to have kind of more of those noble style hops.
Okay.
And some of those can have a little bit of a spice to them. But I think it's a combination.
It's awesome.
And at the beginning, that was very much what I was getting too. It was a real, real sweetness and a little bit of a tartness. But as it's warmed up, now I've got like there's a coating on my tongue, which would be expected from something like this, you know, which I really like.
That coating's the 9.7% alcohol.
9.7. All good right.
But not too busy. Not like sweetness. Like no, it's sickly not viscousy,
like yeah. sugary.
It's got a little bit of a smokiness.
Yeah, see, and the old Rasputin from last time was crazy busy. There was so much going on in that beer that every time you brought it to your lips, you had a different experience. And I mean, that sounds completely over the top, but I think that's accurate. It has so much going on with it, and that's what made it amazing. And I think this one's amazing for the exact opposite reason, is that it is just so base good.
I think this had a lot more
just solid
body buildup. I mean, I don't know if you noticed when you poured, it had what, a 3-finger head, and it stuck for a while.
It did. It lasted a good while.
It was pretty heavy.
Yeah, a nice espresso to it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's got that like figgy plum thing that I love in a stout.
And yeah, this is, I'd drink it again.
Is this part of the Smokestack series?
It is.
Am I even getting that
so,
right?
So, yeah. Okay. So the Smokestack series is kind of their specialty line. It's basically, let's see, what did the website said? Collection of bigger, bolder, more complex beers. Delicious, higher alcohol, great for sipping and sharing. So just kind of a different line, not their usual pale ales and things like that. These are kind of the big brothers.
I don't understand that whole sharing thing. Person comes up to me and they're like, hey man, you got a spare beer? Like,
that's why
what?
You keep shit beer in your fridge for when people need a beer.
I'll give you a beer. I mean, do you want it? But I don't have a spare one.
You know, I don't know. There's some tin barrels I put out in the garage a year ago.
That's harsh.
That was harsh. I'm very
sorry. Okay, Tin Barrel actually makes good beer. They have some great brewers.
They seriously do.
Whitney Burnside does some cool stuff. But so, yeah, they're owned
yeah,
by the
yeah.
devil.
Picking on
they're owned
and
by the
that's
devil.
The thing. It's just hard. It's hard to not see that when you see the bottle or the beer in front of you. No matter
I'm
how much.
I'm not saying I go buy a six-pack, but I would go if there weren't like a 3-hour wait, I would drink a beer at their pub. But
Well, I'll tell you, I have had more Apocalypse IPAs from Tin Barrel than ever before in the last maybe year, because if you go into a divey enough joint, they've got Bud Light, you know, they've got the Silver Bullet going on. They usually have like a Widmer Head, which nothing wrong with Widmer Head. Yeah, a Fat Tire, and then usually some Leinen Coolers or something. But if you see that Apocalypse IPA on there, I'm going to get that every time compared to those other choices.
Sure. If there's Bud or Bud Light on the tap, you know, Apocalypse could be right there with it. Because aren't they the same?
Here we go.
No, but that's what I'm saying is it's there.
No,
it's...
this is Mr. Weiner. I hate IPAs now.
Oh, I thought he was just saying because they came in with the AB order.
No, well, you know, that was a 2-for-1-er, actually.
There you go.
2-for-1 special.
That was.
Well, I like this beer a lot, and I think that the backstory, a lot of what we've just talked about is why we decided to pair this beer with the movie that we're going to talk about tonight, Babadook, because Babadook is also more than the sum of its parts. And, you know, it comes from a heritage much like you could say Boulevard does. You know, it was started grassroots. It was, you know, started by a non-Hollywood, you know, lady that sat down and wrote this script. And then it was picked up by the big boys, and they could have done 100 things in it to twist the message or change it up from what it was and turn it into what I think a lot of people still see it as, which is just a haunted house movie or a ghost story movie or there's a creature in my bedroom
movie.
A boogeyman movie. Exactly.
Yeah. And it's so much more.
But it's not.
But it's not.
It's not.
Dark Truth tells exactly what is going on with Babadook.
It's right there in the name as well.
By the naming.
It's the truth of the whole thing. And before we fully dive into talking about the movie, we have one more thing we got to wrap up with this beer with my lady. Where's she at?
Oh, yeah. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, she's coming.
What kind of... Last time, what was it? Pine needle stored in a diaper for too long?
No, last time she liked it.
Oh, that's right.
Last time it was the old Rasputin.
Because it wasn't an IPA.
Oh, well, you're going to love this one then.
So if you've been with us the last couple episodes, you know what happens now. It is time for Deanne's Dose of Reality, where she will now smell and taste test the... Oh, she's making the throw up face on
Why
the
are you
smell.
Making barf face on
it's
Dark Truth?
Soy sauce.
Oh,
so, yeah. So she's going to tell us what she thinks of the smell and then also the taste.
Soy sauce with all its sodium. None of that low sodium soy sauce.
I like that
Which,
you know the difference in smell on those.
At least that's good soy sauce, though. It needs that sodium. It does. Or some MSG. Whatever. I'm good.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's heavy soy sauce with a little dirt aftertaste.
Dirt aftertaste soy sauce.
There you go.
Well, there it is, our dose of reality.
I really hope you never judge one of my beers at a competition.
And now I have to try it.
Shit.
We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to talk about it, but I still like this beer.
And I can get a lot of stouts put off a soy sauce aroma. That's they not totally do. She's an been uncommon descriptor.
Yep.
You see that a lot. So I don't think it tastes like soy sauce, but I can at least, I can get the smell.
I can see that for sure. Yeah. Well, and taste but being so much. But it's
still delicious. Can.
Pours like it.
Yeah, it does. It, you know, can even look like it at certain times. So, well, there it is. There you have it. But a good beer. I mean, a really good beer. You should be able to find this wherever you're at. It's, like we said, in a lot of states, almost 30 states mm-hmm. now. It might even be more than 30 states now. And apparently it's even overseas in other places. So search this one out if you can. Dark Truth from Boulevard.
It's worth the hunt.
It's really good. It's just a solid beer. Don't be afraid that you're, you know, paying to some brewery that just got bought out, because I'm telling you, this Duvel, I'm not going to say the second word because I'm going to mangle it. You say it for me.
Mortgat?
Mortgat.
I don't even know if I'm saying Duvel, it right.
It sounds better than what I would do.
You
it.
Could say Tudyk
so that,
without losing it. So
the Duvel Mortgat
is something you should be able to handle.
But that group is really doing things the right way when they're taking over breweries, and they're leaving breweries alone to continue doing the things that they did right correctly, and it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Boston Terrier's freaking out in the background.
Always. That's what she does. So, Babadook, man, we saw this movie, Lee, you and I.
And Grace.
And were you there as well?
And Juan, wasn't it?
I think maybe just Juan. At the Hollywood Theater?
About a year and a half ago?
Whenever it was having its first stateside push. You may have
I might have been there.
We chilled at Sam's Billiards.
I just remember drinking a lot of free-range Reds.
I don't remember.
I don't know.
I've drank at a lot of movies.
Yeah. But I do remember this one specifically.
Sorry.
Because I remember walking out of it and stepping onto the sidewalk there in front of the Hollywood Theater and discussing that this was one of the more amazing horror films I had seen in quite some time.
Yeah, I've been disappointed by flicks lately. And when I walked out of that one, I too was like, okay, finally.
Yeah.
That got me.
Which is really funny if you think of what you were thinking, probably at least what I was thinking and what I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about, I don't know, about 15 minutes into this movie, which is there's no way I'm going to make it through this movie. Because of this kid.
Kid is really annoying.
There's just no way it's going to happen.
He's necessary.
I was absolutely
But I want to choke him out.
Were you?
Yep. I was what? Like... Well, I was because... And maybe it wasn't a realization until afterwards, but I thought to myself, this movie is creeping me out because of that kid's acting and what he's doing. There's no jump scares. There's no monsters that are, you know, popping out. There's no cats being thrown across the screen. Just this kid alone is pulling it off for me.
Okay.
Yeah, granted, he was annoying as fuck.
And I came around to that by the end of the film, but it took me a little bit. Mm-hmm. It was maybe halfway, three quarters of the way even before I was really looking at what that kid was doing. And I really wish I had written his name down. Oh, I did. Noah Wiseman was the young guy that played Samuel.
Samuel.
He's a great little actor.
Yeah.
But I kind of wanted to punch him in the throat.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I've seen Jim Carrey a few times in roles that I really enjoy and enough to know that he's a good actor. But my line of humor is not an Ace Ventura, let's say, because every time I see people acting like that, I want to punch them in the face. So I can see how, you know, being a great actor doesn't mean you're not going to get smacked. But this kid, man, he was just asking for it from moment one. And it's something that I now look back on and think, wow, how amazing that they were able to write a character that was just that manipulative of my emotions.
Yeah.
And everyone else's, apparently. Because yeah. I don't know of anybody that just went in there and was like, oh, yeah, it's just a kid. He's fine.
No.
Well, and it was just one half of the duo. Because Essie Davis, who played Amelia's mother, had an equal range of emotions that she added to
totally.
That. Just without one, you couldn't have had the other. And it's just, she was heartbreaking is what she was in the beginning.
Yeah, this movie starts on such a sour note. I mean, the first things we see are her fever dreams, reliving an auto accident, which took her husband from her, took Samuel's dad. And we eventually learn that this auto accident occurred as they were going to the hospital for Samuel to be born. And instantly you already know, or you should at least, I mean, if you have some empathy, what's now happening. You know, here's a lady that is going to put those feelings on this kid, whether he deserves it or not. And when they write Samuel's character to be as just irritating and off-putting as they did, you double down on the fact that she must just not be able to handle this kid for so many reasons, on an emotional level.
Yeah, and they established that real quick.
Very fast.
In fact, I remember watching it back then and thinking, yeah, this was a really good psychological thriller, but not a whole lot of, you know, creature support, is all delivered on acting. And then rewatched it here a couple of days ago. And right out of the gate, I remember why I was pulled in, because they get shit established at the beginning and they do it well and they never let go of you.
Very quick. And it's amazing how it's very easy to pick up where the movie is headed, as far as you're going to have a mom who is severely depressed and dealing with a lot of emotions that she just hasn't fully managed to deal with yet. And you're going to have a kid that's going to push every one of those buttons, and eventually there's going to be some tension. And yeah, you're going to introduce a ghost or a creature or a boogeyman, as Grace said, into this house now. You're going to have some problems. And it's so easy to see it at face value there and to still think, yeah, it's a pretty good movie. Mm-hmm. They've done a really great job. But then, and I'm sure we'll talk about it as we move on here, but then you get into the deeper layers of this and the actual meanings of things. And then you watch it a second time. It's more amazing how quickly they set all of that up.
This movie has layers.
Oh, for sure. It's an onion. Like an ogre.
Oh, God.
Someone had to Shrek this up, right? No?
No. God, nobody had to Shrek
this up. I just talked about the fact I can't watch Ace Ventura and I'm throwing Shrek quotes.
Yeah, you no longer get to hate on Ace because...
Okay. I just shouldn't ever step outside of horror as a genre. Because once I'm out of horror, my taste is all over the place. I apologize. Buffet. I apologize to everyone.
Well, for as much emotion that this movie's already evoking out of us just in the conversation, it's amazing that it was actually kind of a flop right out of the gate in its homelands of Australia.
Was it in Australia?
Yeah. I didn't know. Apparently it was not received well, and it was just really initially not a commercial success at all.
So this is theatrically, I'm assuming, we're talking about
it. Yeah, in art house theaters and things like that and whatnot.
That surprises me.
And it, I think it, at the time in its native country, mm-hmm. it only grossed about $250,000.
Wow.
And it was made for, I think, $2 million. So it just, it's so nice that an independent like this, mm-hmm. her first, I mean, she was an actor and a director. Jennifer Kent?
Kent,
mm-hmm. yeah. For her to do this, and it grow into such a thing, especially when failure was knocking on her door. Kind of at the get-go. But once it started hitting the film festivals like Sundance mm-hmm. and it started getting a little bit more international, then it exploded.
And I wonder if it's that led to its award wins in Australia, or if it's just the fact that that's a good reason we have academies, because they can dig through the things that those first audiences go,
but, you
and
know,
they can pull the gems out. But this won the equivalent of the Australian Academy Awards, and I forget what the name of it is now, but it won Best Film, Best Director, and Best Screenplay.
It had to come back because according to...
That's trifecta of wins.
Yeah. Well, it had to come back because it was initially in an interview that I watched with Jennifer Kent. She just kind of said that Australians really don't get behind their own stuff.
Mm, okay.
So, you know,
that's worth. Right there, yeah.
But no, not too bad. I mean, it grossed like $10.5 million. So
wow,
first movie out making $7.5 million profit. Yeah. Not too shabby.
No, that's not shabby at all.
Yeah.
We were talking about a film earlier, Valhalla Rising. It's on Netflix. Don't watch it. It's the art house Viking film that no one ever wanted or needed. And its budget
Vikings
was five and a half.
Horns on there?
No, Vikings do not have horns on there.
I'll bet you there were Viking horns in this one, though.
Oh, my God. No, there weren't. There were barely Vikings. I don't even want to talk about this movie. Other than to say it had a $5.5 million budget, and it brought in $31,000.
Jesus Christ.
$31,000 off of a $5.5 million budget. So, yeah, there are flops, and then there are flops. And that one still made it onto Netflix. So,
hey, Babadook's on Netflix.
Yeah, I guess that's true too, right? one of my favorite things is that, and again, like we said, we're going to talk about a little bit more of the layers on this movie and, yeah. and what we pulled from it. And we, I think, on this podcast are going to do our best to avoid major spoilers. I mean, obviously, we have to give away plot points and fun scenes that happen yeah. and things, but we still want you to be able to go and watch one of these movies if you haven't seen it. And if you haven't, awesome. We'd love to win you over so you do. Or to watch it a second time if you have. And we would love you to be able to, you know, enjoy it all over again. Without us ruining it. But I think this movie, we're going to have to go off that rail a little bit.
It's always tough. Every single one we've done so far.
Yeah.
But
and this one deserves it. I think that's okay on this one. Yeah. Because, A, I think everyone who wanted to see this one now has at this point. The people that didn't, you know, have listened to all the people that are like, oh, it's just an annoying kid, and it's just this, and it's just that. I think they've already forgotten about it, and they're not going back. So I think we're on some safer territory, maybe than some obscure, you know, 80s slasher flick or something right. on this one. And hopefully when we do delve into this a little bit more, we'll twang that nerve on a few people and make you want to go and watch this one on the Netflix, or even better yet, go support it and pick up a copy. Cause,
yeah, well, like we keep saying, it's got layers. It needs to be revisited. Apparently, even the director said, you know, I didn't really start out to just make a horror film,
yeah.
you know, or a psychological horror. She was actually drawn to the idea of putting a face on what grief and suppression of that grief would look like, and kind of how it would affect a person mm-hmm. and how that might, you know, be translated into some different genre.
Well, and that I actually wrote a quote down from her from an interview I was watching, and I thought it summed it up completely perfectly, where she was saying the same things. This is the theme I wanted to get across, the theme of, you know, anxiety, severe depression, and loneliness, isolation, all of those things. And her quote was, can you imagine this story as a domestic drama? It would be so melodramatic and stupid. And I think that's true. If you go back and you watch the films that are supposed to be about someone's grief and their loss and their this and their that, 9 out of 10 times, they're so over the top, or they're so Hollywood version, at least.
Yeah, it's like you're watching the Lifetime Network, because exactly. men hurt you.
Right.
You know,
and it's going to be so overly sympathetic to your plight that it's going to get sappy at some point in trying to tell what should be just a very straightforward idea, because this is real horror. This isn't vampires. This isn't, you know, monsters, boogeymen. This isn't Cthulhu. This isn't any of those things. This is the horror that people actually live with, like stuff that is scary for people every day. And putting it in a horror movie was so genius, because you now watch it and you think to yourself, well, the reason that I can see this being so terrifying is this monster in the closet, until you realize what that monster in the closet really represents. And it makes you very uncomfortable.
Yeah. They see, that's it for me. Exactly. When I watched this, I was saying, okay, this is a really good flick that has a monster in it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I walked away from.
Me too.
The very first time. Mm-hmm. I was like, it's great. And then I didn't read any reviews or anything, just, you know, revisited, and all of a sudden, and this is absolutely how I think this movie needs to be watched. If anybody, you know, hears this, stop now. Don't listen anymore, but still support us. But don't listen anymore.
pause is what he meant. Not stop, yes, just yeah. pause.
Watch it as a horror flick, and then come back and watch it as if somebody put the face on severe depression and grief, mm-hmm. and there really was no monster. It is fucking genius.
Yeah, it absolutely.
And I may have given away too much right there, but
that's fine. We're going to dive into this thing.
We gave them fair warning.
I think at this point, yeah. And again, I mean, people have read reviews like this. If somebody posts on a Facebook forum or something, hey, should I watch The Babadook? I mean, it's going to be a war. It's going to be, you know, 25 people saying, this is the most boring piece of crap I've ever seen. I walked out on it. Oh, my God, it's so stupid. Oh, I couldn't watch it because of that kid, which, you know, comes up more often than not. And then it's going to be about 5 people that say, you guys obviously don't see the story under the story.
Yeah.
Or maybe you do see it, and that's just not your cup of tea. But if you want to appreciate it, that's the story you look for. And I agree with you the second time.
Maybe some people don't like onions.
You know, everybody likes parfait.
I actually hate
everybody likes parfait.
You started the shark shit.
It's my fault.
No, and I think it's one of those that this is one of those movies that it's scarier for people if you've experienced this.
Yeah.
If you've lived with someone, or if you've gone through some sort of deep depression or grief
mm-hmm.
or anxiety or all of those things, it becomes more real. Because it is a monster. It is scary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that lives with you. Terrifying. It's something you can't get away from, and you have to find a way to deal with it and live a life. And, you know, for somebody like a parent, a single mom, she has to learn to deal with that and compartmentalize that and take care of her kid, who's not the easiest of kids.
Which will be the nicest thing we say about that kid for the rest of the show.
In some ways, you know, it's even harder for her because, you know, we kind of alluded to she has issues with the fact, you know, it's hard for her not to even just blame the kid because they were on the way to the hospital to have him.
Yeah.
So, exactly. I mean, there's all these like deep twist, dark and twisty things going on.
Oh, yeah.
But they're all very real.
Very much so.
They're just given the
This movie kind of pissed me off in the sense that if this was like as I was flipping through the channels and I saw some TV show about, you know, depression and handling anxiety and grief and shit like that, I'd be like, click.
Yeah. Right?
So fucker snuck in some social, you know, awareness.
Yeah.
You know, into my brain underneath the guise of a horror movie. So, you know, I applaud them on that. It was brilliant.
When people have talked, I mean, critics especially have talked for decades now about the catharticism of horror and how we all need it because it exposes parts of ourselves that are on the underneath and we can confront them on the screen. And that way we're, you know, more prepared for them in real life. We've heard that for so long. And sure, you could create speeches and things like that to explain why anybody likes anything. But if you wanted to have an example of that, it's here.
It's right here. Like it's sneaky and to the point, but you don't realize it.
Yeah.
At least not the first time you watch it.
Sorry, I was distracted. I'm actually looking at the TV watching it right now. And it just occurred to me, one of the great things about this is that they didn't use any CG. Everything going on there is all practical.
Yeah.
And that is just brilliant. Even when they're showing hints of whatever this thing is.
Mm-hmm. It's all shadows it's lighting. It's so tangible, man.
Just a couple moments in its movements, I noticed they did some layering and some streaking and things like that. Just when it moved very quickly or, you know, again, just it's kind of...
But you don't even see it very often.
No.
No.
And that's kind of what I like. It's all sounds and shadows and... You know, lights flickering
I mean, one of the main props and elements and story points of this entire movie is a book. It's a pop-up book.
Yep. And so that's so tangible. It's the
antithesis? What is that word there?
Yes.
It's the opposite of what we talked about last episode when we were talking about The Void, and we loved diving into rubber monsters and spray tentacles and grossness. And on this one, I love it because, like, the most terrifying thing in the film is a top hat and a pop-up book.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that took an amazing amount of filmmaking ability just right there to set up that much atmosphere that just makes you afraid of everything you're seeing.
Yeah, the book is really interesting. I mean, first of all, I mean, there's a lot we can talk about just the book itself because that sets up the whole turn of events, really. But the name, I want to talk about the name really quick.
Sure.
Apparently, it's pronounced Babadook rather than Babadook, apparently.
That's the way they all say it. I just assumed it's because it's the accent.
Yeah, but, no, apparently that's a thing. But she created a name that a child would make up because it's a story about this child bringing, sort of being exposed to this evil.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout a great deal of the movie, they lead you to believe that it's just his wild imagination and his diving into being fearful because right at the get-go of the movie, he's already, you know, driving his mother insane by saying, hey, there's a monster in my bed. There's a monster in my closet. There's a monster here. There's a monster there. The monster there. And the mom is like, you know, stressed out and not getting any rest. But I thought it was really interesting that she decided that she really wanted it to be something that, one, hadn't been heard before. It wasn't really something that you would identify with as sort of a trope for other genres or anything like that. But it really sounded more like something a child would have created
in his own mind.
I
want to talk a little bit more about that when we get on in this. So I'm actually going to write myself a little note about that because I have a theory on some of that, on why the Babadook
Babadook
is what it is. It's shaped the way it is, looks the way it is, and all of that kind of things. Yeah. And I think it starts with little Samuel, but...
Yeah. Lee, by the way, named this episode Bubba Drink.
Bubba Drink. I saw that. I saw that message earlier. Bubba Drink.
Fitting.
And fair. So, again, this film starts out now single mother, raising a child. The issues with that in his behavior that we've been alluding to are just that. His behavior is out of control. He is lost in a fantastical imaginary world of his own making. He's terrified of all sorts of things in his own house, monsters, creatures, things that he is making weapons and things to defend himself against. He is semi-obsessed mm-hmm. with the idea of his missing father. Obviously, he never met his father because his father died on the way to deliver him. But he is hyper aware that that is what happened.
Right.
He talks about it to strangers. He brings it up in the grocery store to an absolute stranger at one point. So we, the audience, are told he knows his dad died, bringing him into the world. And our assumption there is that mom has probably blamed him before
mm-hmm.
for this.
And this storyline starts during his upcoming birthday, which mm-hmm. you've got to think, oh my God, she's thinking, well, I've got to celebrate my child's birthday. Fuck that. That's the day that my, you know, husband and love of my mm-hmm. life died.
So we find out he's never had a birthday party all his own.
Not on his birthday and not his own party.
He's been sharing a birthday with, what, is his cousin, his mom's sister's kid? Yeah, I'm not sure if
is it his mom's sister or just his mom's friend?
Nope, that's her sister.
That explains.
So okay. He's had to have a shared birthday party on a day that isn't even his birthday because his mom can't bring herself to celebrate anything on his actual birthday. So, and again, all of these things are made so plainly aware to us that have affected this kid's behavior and his demeanor and the way that he sees himself and his relationship with his mom. And it's, I think you used the word heartbreaking earlier, and it's heartbreaking before you even know what's going to happen in this movie or where this movie is taking you. You're already so sad for these two characters.
You go into this movie knowing, hey, this is a horror movie, but the first, I don't know how long, 20 minutes or so is all just about the, what you're describing right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's no mention of a monster. There's no mention of the Babadook, nothing mm-hmm. like that. You're just like, holy shit, this mom's getting driven insane by this fucking kid that you want to strangle.
Yeah. This kid is really into a magician. He has a DVD or a VHS or something of a magician that teaches you tricks. Mm-hmm. And he loves to try to perform these tricks for his mom. Of course, never when she's ready, always when she's the most tired or the most distracted or the most irritated or whenever. And it begins just like you would expect with the mom, 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 mom. Yep. And he does these amateur magic shows that he gets right is the thing. And so if you were watching any other movie, mom would be like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
He's actually really good at
That's crazy cool what you just did right there. But it just makes her more mad and more angry.
It's just the opposite of what you think. And, mm-hmm. and in fact, that was one of the things that the director was kind of worried about, was she thought that there was she was going to get a lot of flack from viewers and whatnot about portraying the mother in such a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
She really thought that flawed parenting and, you know, this kind of distancing was going to cause a lot of negative vibes mm-hmm. for the film, but she really wanted to bring that sense of, you know, what it is like to be a parent and to be a single parent, a woman that doesn't always have mm-hmm. the best and purest of thoughts during trying times raising a child.
You know who she would catch that flack from is parents that don't have these problems. Yeah. Parents that aren't suffering from severe depression and these feelings that she's suffering from, those are the parents that would be like, oh, you're just not a good mom. And I think that's must make this movie so amazing to watch if you are that mom.
Because you don't get to see that very often in this, especially in this kind of way.
Yeah. Never from the inside.
Yeah.
That's always a character we see from the outside and there's never a motivation or a reasoning or any kind of understanding brought to the role. It's always just, wow, that's a crazy person.
Treating their kid like shit.
Yeah. No, instead she gives you the perspective of a broken parent.
Yeah.
And that's a very real thing. There's a lot of people that are, you know,
beyond their control and beyond any doing of their own. You know, I mean, things happen to people in life. And that's the other reason I think that the impetus of this whole thing, that this started in an accident, it was so important. You know, this yeah. isn't a mom that's strung out on drugs and lost her way with her kid and now has to redeem herself. And I could see a ghost movie being written that way. You know, that's the kind of like little edgy drama that Hollywood loves to throw into its crap. This is just a lady that she did nothing to deserve this. Neither did that kid. You know, neither did the husband. I mean, this is just the sucky part of life.
Right.
Her job. Talking about the sucky parts of life. Her job, even. And yeah. That's another very important thing to this story is that when you, you know, think of this mom also, you're like, well, why don't you just go in the other room? Why don't you just go for a drive? Why don't you just do this? Why don't you just do that? But then you start to see what she does do with all of her time.
And she doesn't get a break.
She's helping other extremely difficult people to help. She works with dementia patients and infirm elderly, and gets just stretched again so thin
mm-hmm.
doing well, that what does she have left when she gets home?
No, she's got nothing but resentment and aggression and stress that she takes out on her kid
mm-hmm.
and sometimes really quite verbally violent.
Definitely.
Especially as it gets into the movie. That was one of the cool things that, when reading some of the reviews and diving into the making of,
mm-hmm.
is that clearly you can't have, you know, a mom figure or an actress saying to a 6-year-old kid horrible things and cussing and things like that. So the filming of sort of doing, reverse shots was really important because you don't want to fuck up a 6-year-old kid's life
yeah.
by you know exactly, yeah. throwing him into a movie like this and actually having him present during yeah. that thing. I think there's a part in
the couple movie, moments yeah, still
where I wish you were dead and mm-hmm. you know things like that. So just the genius of taking the kid and saying, I want you to go over here and just say, hey, shout this and shout that when nobody's around, you know.
Yeah.
And then cut that into a scene where the mom has got a knife or something, you know, it's just
totally,
I really respect that level of commitment, which
that's really cool. Cause sometimes you do think about that when some, you know, somebody's yelling at a kid or making fun of a kid yeah. or saying completely lewd things or whatever in front of a child actor. And you're always kind of like, I wonder how this is affecting this kid.
Yeah. How's it, are they aware of it? They've got to protect them. You know, they protect yeah. the animals, right?
So it's nice to see there is a plan in process on some of these too.
Well, my buddy Eric, he got his daughter involved. I think she was 7-8 years old at the time in a real short film. It was Ghoul Fest thing that mm-hmm. they do where they literally say, hey, Portland area, we're coming to town. We're going to have surprise mystery plots that we'll give you. And then you have 72 hours to make a movie. You got to write a script, get edited,
yeah. put music,
all that. And Sophia was part of that, and she was basically a dead child that was a ghost, which you didn't find out until the end. And the two parents, the mom and – yeah, I just totally spoiled it. Spoiler alert.
It's over. Sorry. Okay.
Well, thanks for listening to us. See you later. No, and there were the two dads and the dad that caused the child's death is basically what it turned out to be accidentally, and the new mom and the new dad – at odds at a funeral.
Okay.
And the scenes where Sophia was a ghost and talking to people and they were cursing and they were doing all this stuff, I got to hear a lot of the backstory about how they took her in a room all by herself and they described, you know, so I want you to pretend like you're talking to, you know, Teddy Ruxpin or some shit like that.
Sure.
But when they spliced it together, you could swear to God that they were...
That's awesome.
Piper's got some opinions about that.
She sure does.
So, yeah. So, when I read this, I was like, yeah, that's Hollywood magic. You know, it's very cool.
Yeah. So, we were talking about the mom's job. She comes home from said job and instantly starts to help her neighbor,
mm-hmm.
who I think Parkinson's was her yeah. issue. So, she has an elderly lady also no longer has her husband with her. No one to help her out, no family there. And this mom comes home from her job, helps her out, helps get her situated, helps get her dinner, whatnot. Then goes in and we see several times her routine with Sam of eating a super drab dinner that she whips together in like 2 pots. And it looks the same kind of every time we see it. And then searches the house for monsters. so that she can then take him to bed and read him stories while trying just to get him to go to sleep long enough to go to work the next day. So we really get the vibe of how caught in her cycle she is and unable to get a moment's breath anywhere. And I think that helps explain a lot of when she is doing those ragey moments and screaming and just losing herself, because where else is she going to let that out?
Yeah. Let me tell you something, man. If you have never been a parent, that shit's real just with normal kids. You gotta live, you gotta support, you gotta work, you gotta take care of the kid, you gotta get rest. And it is all based on that kid's fucking schedule, not yours.
Yeah.
And it quickly takes you down. And just watching him constantly wake up her mom, his mom, so reminded me of the days when there was no sleep on the horizon, man.
Yeah.
And so it's.
And what can you do? There's nothing you can do. You can wake up, deal with the issue, and every now and then snap and say something dumb.
Right.
I mean, that's how it goes. That's the reality of it.
Yeah. It tests your mettle, and it's, and that's in a normal world, you know, let alone having this kind of grief on top of it. So it's fucking powerful.
And what are you going to do to someone who's suffering from severe depression and all of this just emotional turmoil? You're going to tell them, oh, you just need to take some you time. You just need to get a little bit more rest. Oh, you're running yourself ragged. Oh, you're doing this or that. Maybe turn to your family. Maybe turn to your friends. Well, it's very clear she has no friends. Right. And she makes a few mentions as the fact that one of the reasons that she and Sam both don't have friends is his behavior. But she does have some family, which we've talked about is her sister, who is also so well written because her sister could not be less caring about her problems. Her sister is so self-absorbed that every one of – what's the mom's name again? Amelia? Every one of Amelia's problems – it's just making things terrible for the sister. Oh, it's just causing my life such grief. Or, oh, yeah, him coming over for his birthday with her is done. She can't deal with that anymore. He's too weird. He's,
yeah.
So even the things that you would suggest for a person like that to do, can't do any of them.
She has no support system.
Nothing. And then a pop-up book shows up.
Yes.
I mean, literally, just like that.
Yeah. During one of the nights.
One of the routines.
When Samuel was being a real dick. Mom says, all right, let me read your book. And
lets him choose that
night. And he chooses. Mm-hmm. That's a key right there. So. That's an interesting key right there. And it turns out to be this red-covered bound book or something like that that she doesn't really recall ever seeing before.
Which, can I just tell you how sad I am that I did not get on that whole Kickstarter or Indiegogo or whatever it was.
I got a whole fucking thing about that, man. It's me too. There's 1,000 of them originally set, I think.
Okay.
And they were going for $80 each.
It was something like that. And I just kept thinking, I don't know. I'll get around to it. I'll do it maybe when I get paid.
They ended up publishing 6,200 of them because of the demand, which is great for her. She got the money for it. But now you can't find them.
Oh, no.
And if you do, they're $500-$700.
As they should be.
On the internet.
Because if they're anything like the one in the film, they're amazing. And I'm sure – I heard they're exactly
– yeah. Well, and that was another thing about it is they actually had somebody craft it by hand, you know, and it goes back to that, you know, not –
tactile, man.
Yeah, very tactile.
Put tactile shit in your movies. Yeah. That's going to be a message, I think, for us for the rest of this show.
It really is.
Shove your CGI so far up your ass that we don't have to look at it anymore.
That's fair.
The next time I see a digital blood explosion of some sort,
I'm going to... And I'm cool. I mean, if you want to put that in your TV show, you know, if you want to put that in some, I don't know, what's a TV show? The Defenders or some crap that people are watching. If you want to put that in there... Defenders is the new, Daredevil, Iron Fist.
Yeah,
like,
it's the Avengers.
Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, all that kind of stuff. Street cred. Which, I don't want to make it seem like I didn't watch those, because I watched some of those. I didn't watch Luke Cage. I couldn't get into it. I could absolutely not watch Iron Fist, although I tried and tried. That is a terrible goddamn character. Oh, my God. He's just terrible. But I loved the Jessica Jones a lot. And the Daredevil.
I really enjoyed that one. I can see why some people were getting a little tired of the routine of it. But
see, in something like that is what I'm getting at. You want to throw some blood spray and stuff. I'm not going to cry about it. Because in that film, it's an afterthought. But in horror, as a genre, since the beginning of the genre, it's what you see you have to believe. That's the point.
Yeah.
That's the point of horror. If you were showing me things I didn't believe, it's not horror anymore. It's not scary. It's not anything.
It's almost like you take a movie like, say, Die Hard.
Okay.
And you're like, okay, this dude's going to do some pretty incredible things. You can either like say that's a shitty movie, or you can have suspension of disbelief and go along with it.
Yeah.
Get a sci-fi movie. Suspension of disbelief. They're out of space. Sure. They're fucking shooting lasers and shit. When it comes to horror, you can't have a sense of suspension of disbelief, even though obviously what's happening is ridiculous.
Fantastical, yeah.
You have to believe it.
Or it's not scary.
Right. Or it's not doing its thing. Exactly.
Yeah. Totally. Well, so the book shows up. It is a pop-up book, and it is titled simply Babadook.
Mr. Babadook.
That's correct.
I believe.
And it, you know, without memorizing every page here, it basically just tells a little rhyme that gets a tiny bit more sinister each page you flip.
Yeah.
About this Mr. Babadook that is in your house. And
I
what
love
what happens if you let him in.
Yes.
Yes. I love the build up to it where the mom's like, oh, okay, this is a cute pop up book. Let me read it to my son.
Sure.
And it goes along and they don't show her, they don't have her reading it, if I remember. They show you the words.
Yes, they show us the page and the page maybe and a little words. Bit of her hand turning each page a little bit slower each time as she realized, I'm not sure I'm on board with this, where this is going.
And then she keeps going.
And wants to stop, but Sam's like, you said I can pick. And she knows what's coming if she says no.
Right.
She's going to get one of those tantrums, one of those screamy fits, one of those things that she is so sick of dealing with. So she finishes the book.
She keeps going. Next scene. Fucking kid screaming his ass off, curled up in his mom's lap.
Yep.
And you just know that's been going on for hours.
Yeah, because the book is like closed and over here. And she's reading, like, I think, like a, you know, prince or princess. Like,
she's trying to read, something.
He's still just not digging it. So, and again, this goes back to, I think, kind of what I want to hit on a little bit later here, because it's going to tie in a lot of things the way I kind of see them is very interesting. But, The Babadook is basically just a trench coat with really long claw-like fingers, a top hat, and some wiry hair.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're seeing. Oh, and a big Cheshire grin in
big
certain areas.
Pale, black and white.
Mm-hmm. Very cabinet of Dr. Caligari to me. Like, extremely, if you guys have seen that film.
London After Midnight?
Also extremely similar.
Okay, so that's not
The
same.
It's not.
Okay.
No, this was about a somnambulist and I don't know, a bunch of other things. We're not going to go into that. But the imagery is super cool, very stark, very plain, and is very important, I think, to why it exists. Well, this pop-up book now gives this kid what he has always wanted, which is a name to what he's afraid of.
Right.
So he now has a name for the monster. He knows what it looks like. He has actually been warned by the words in the book as to what this thing is going to do to him and his mom, and that it's coming and it's, you know, you cannot let it in. And that's just the slow unraveling.
And the interesting thing, too, is I forget when they actually show it. It's either at this point or shortly after that there's blank pages.
Yes.
Three or four blank pages at the end of this book.
It's at this time. She flips through the kind of the last couple. It's after that night and right before she decides that she's going to destroy this dumb thing.
Yeah, didn't she like put it up on
She tries a few times to destroy it.
She hides it and it shows back up. And she finally just decides, I don't want Samuel reading this thing again. I'm going to shred it. And she tears it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was somewhere in there that she flips through it and we see that there are blank pages.
Right.
Shortly after this, it turns back up, retaped, repasted, reassembled, re-put back together, and with some more info on those following pages, which is even...
These ones are even more, because this one starts saying, hey, look, you let me in.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get rid of me. That's what some of the first wordings were. You're going to hear three knocks. You know, you're going to hear a rumbling, you know, so that kind of rhyme type thing. And sure enough, you hear these knocks, three knocks on the door, and there's nothing there. And then she closes the door. She comes back because there's three more knocks and there's the book on the doorstep. And like you say, she opens it up and now there's more written in, which is even more brutal because now it starts showing the mom being affected and the son being affected physically.
Now she has a name for something she's terrified of and afraid of and tormented by.
Now, here's something here. I don't know if I'm just reading into it or what, but when she takes that book and goes to the police, well, she doesn't take the book. She burns it then.
Puts it on the barbecue out back and lights it up.
But she goes to the police and she's like, there's people stalking and threatening me and my child. And the cop's like, okay, what's going on? And he's like, well, there's this book and it was threatening and I tore it up. And then there was new pages on it. And the cop's like, well, where's the book?
Yeah.
I burned it. They do a little thing where they look down at her hands, and her hands are all dark with charcoal, which is exactly what the Babadook book is written in. And I didn't catch that.
Yeah, this.
I thought, holy shit, is this a manifestation now? Is this where we're starting to see the hints that this is something other than just a horror flick? This is her manifestation and recognition of her.
This might be a good time. I might as well just dive into what I'm dying to get into over here. But when Sam is performing his magic tricks, he dons a cape. A cloak.
Yes.
He dons a top hat, much as the Babadook wears. He does performances in the basement for people that are basically just clothing hung on coat racks.
His dad's
hung
clothing.
On the wall. His dad's clothing, because he's performing for his dad, really. And a hat.
Which that basement is off limits.
He's not supposed to be down there, because that's where all of dad's belongings are. And there are images that you see of Sam that are very... I guess you could say they lead up to what we end up seeing the Babadook looking like. And yes, this book, where did it come from? She says, I don't remember this book. I don't remember having this book. I don't remember where the... So you begin to get the idea on, at least on a couple of extra viewings, that this book is something she's manifesting. And I haven't decided whether I think it's that that book actually even exists or not.
Yeah, and that's what it is. You're looking at it, at first, you're like, oh, okay, this is a spooky book. Mm-hmm. It's appeared supernaturally, you know, when you're watching it as a horror flick.
Sure.
Dive deeper into it, and the genius, the brilliance of what it could really be.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Sam is there with her when she reads it to him, and she wants to stop, and he says, no, 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 more, more, more. It's not that he's reading it. It's not that he's flipping through it. It's not that he's writing, you know, this tale, perhaps. It's entirely possible that she wasn't even holding that book, that she was reading some other book, but spewing out a little bit of that madness that we know is coming now, a little bit of that just full psychotic break that we know is on its way for her. So on going back to it, seeing the way they hinted so much that he kind of dresses like this monster that she feels is tormenting her, is so much more of an indication that this is just a manifestation of basically the feelings.
Yeah, that extreme grief and that living, you know, with
and
this since her husband
that goes
died.
To the police station when she's there and he says, where's the book? She goes, oh, I don't have it. He goes, where's the book? She goes, oh, I burned it. And right after that moment, she sees a coat hanging on a wall in the back of that police station, just like
the Babadook.
Just like the Babadook and just like her kid. Hangs things down in that basement on the wall. And it, for a second for her, is the Babadook. Yeah. And it freaks her the fuck out right there in the middle of the police station. So there's so many things that lead us to believe that this is... I mean, obviously, any haunted movie, we want there to be only one person that experiences the haunting so everyone can think that they're crazy and everyone cannot believe them until at the end when it rips through the walls and the house catches on fire and all that bullshit. But in this one... I think maybe quite realistically, she's the only one seeing any of this. She's the only one hearing those knocks. She's the only one that has dreamt up the existence of this book to try to deal with these monsters inside of her.
Yeah, because it is. It's anyone that suffered from any kind of like debilitating loss or grief. You just don't erase that emotional pain.
No.
You just don't. It stays with you. There's no drug that can cure it. It's permanently part of what's going to relegate your past.
Oh, definitely.
And I think kind of understanding this on those other levels is super important with seeing what this movie really is.
Yeah.
Because you can see the physical manifestation of this spirit and you can think, oh shit, okay, there's a ghost, you know, but it's not. It's really just a manifestation of the extreme grief that she's been going through.
Well, and in the book, when it shows back up, those additional pages, the content of those pages is her. I mean, a straight depiction of her.
Right. And
doing severe violence to her child. you know, cutting his head off, basically, stabbing him with a knife, killing their animal. It's in the book. And this is where the movie heads. You know, these are prophecies. This is foretelling. This is something that this movie goes to.
Yeah.
It's her doing violence to that child and her doing violence to their pet.
And what I love about it is it doesn't really explicitly put together in the film that mm-hmm. this book doesn't exist and that it's just her.
Sure.
But it's there's plenty of evidence that you start seeing.
And I think that was just her last little bit of cognitive awareness saying, hey, I know I'm going down a dark road and I know where this is going, and desperately trying to blame it on something which she has now been given by her kid. Through all of his fantasies, he has given her an out. He has said, Mom, this house has monsters. Mom, this house has terrible things in it that I'll protect you from. Don't you worry. When that terrible thing is in her brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, jumping back to our beer, since I just looked down and saw the bottle, that's the dark truth.
Absolutely.
Of this film. And you could watch this movie that first time and go, yeah, it's about a Babadook monster and it's foretold in a haunted book. And then it comes and they finally, you know, meet it and battle it face to face at the end of the film and all that sort of thing. But even if you did that, the ending scenes should be enough to tell you, no, no, no.
Yeah.
That's not what you're watching here.
It's, yeah, and we'll get, I definitely want to get to, yeah. to the end. And this is one of those ones where I've got to give spoilers, but it absolutely is the explanation for why we don't actually see, a lot of this on screen or explained, because, you know, the Babadook is, I mean, when you really step back, it's almost exclusively told from Amelia's perspective.
Yeah.
Because again, she's reading the book. The kid didn't pick it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she went up to the bookcase and grabbed it, you know, so, and that really just talks about her really hyper emotional, state.
But you do see Sam being affected by it, because a kid's going to be affected by his parents' depression.
Yeah, and that's what's so cool about it is when you start reading into what Sam's reaction is. Maybe they played with words a little bit by saying mm-hmm. monster, but he's like, you know, how many kids, innocent kids, and kids are innocent until taught otherwise. And how many innocent kids will see a parent having a bad day and go up and pat it on the head and say, it's okay, Mama, I'll take care of you.
Yeah.
Right? And mm-hmm. that's what he's doing. She's not fighting a fucking monster. He's like, it's okay, Mom, chill.
He tries to save her.
I know you're having a bad day.
Yeah.
I'll take care of you.
He's showing her the weapons he has designed to defend her against the monsters in the house. And, of course, you know, breaks a window or a mirror or something that he smashes with. Like, which just enrages her even further. But still, in the next scenes, he's, I'm going to protect you. I'm going to save you.
His actions are pure.
He's
trying to save his mom from... Mm-hmm. What he sees is a monster, but he doesn't know how. He doesn't know how to beat that monster. He doesn't know how to protect her.
And he feels it coming. He knows something is on the rise. He knows things are about to get super serious. And he just doesn't know why. So he blames it on something scary. And then if his mom goes and tells him a story, whether she read it from a book or not, that's what he's going to call it. And so I think it's great that she fed him that name,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it was in a book or not, you know, however you see that. And then he used that name to describe her mental illness, basically, and how it was inside her and how she had to let it in and how, you know, he now needs to try to protect her, which is saving her from herself.
Get really. It out.
Yeah, because how many 6-year-olds, you know, or 7-year-olds think that they can handle an intruder breaking into the house? They're like, oh, I'll punch him really hard.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'll stop him.
I sharpened a stick and I strung a string across the door, and we're good.
Yeah, yeah. And it's true. I mean, even I had that experience. You know, especially when you talk to children about strangers, and you have those kind of conversations, they're like, "Oh, well, I'll just punch him really hard and I'll scream a lot." It's like, yeah. Okay, good on you, but no.
Yeah.
So, you know, how much more do we dive into?
Well,
because the ending has some really incredible.
It really does, and I think it's important to talk about the ending, to be quite honest. I mean, I think it is, if we're going to really say our piece about this film, and I don't think we have to spell it out for people, but whether you're seeing this movie as there's a monster in the house, or whether you're seeing it as there's a monster in this lady's brain, the movie does not end with the monster gone. The monster stays.
She has to live with it.
Yeah, the monster is there. And like I said, we don't need to describe the scenes and things like that.
No, in fact, but the last half, or the whatever, two-thirds of the movie where there's the big crescendo, where all the drama starts happening, is probably left best unsaid.
Sure.
So that people that haven't seen it can certainly experience it. But the ending is absolutely one of those things where you start paralleling
when
the monster supposedly really appears and Amelia is terrified by it, but then she has Samuel in her arms and she's like any mother, she suddenly turns into, you know, Mama Bear, and she shouts down this creature.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. I'm facing my depression. I'm facing my anxiety, and I'm realized that it just about ruined my life, and I'm now coming out of this darkness and I'm fighting.
Exactly. Which is why I think it's so truly important that it has that last scene, which, and again, reading a lot of people's reviews, reading comments, you know, in social media and on different horror forums, things like that, people are mad at that last scene. People that saw this movie as a haunted house movie and a boogeyman movie are really mad at that last scene because it can be taken kind of goofy in one context. It can be taken just kind of haphazardly tossed in there to wrap things up in another context. But I think it's extremely important that they showed the way they did that the Babadook is still there. It hasn't gone anywhere because that's real depression in real life. You don't fix it. You don't cure it. And this is something that, you know, I've only learned in the last couple of years in my personal life, but you can't fix it away or nice it away or help it away or, you know, demand it go away or
no, it's
none of that.
You tuck it into a corner of your brain,
or figure out how to manage it,
and you deal with it when you have to. Mm-hmm. And other than that, you pretend it's not there.
Mm-hmm. And there's, gosh, I just want to say it.
Hey, we do it.
Okay,
do it.
In the last scene, she feeds it.
Yes,
she goes into the basement and feeds
on Samuel's birthday.
The creature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he finally gets his real birthday.
It's in the basement, which was off limits. It's territory you cannot explore. Is probably a great way to say it.
Where all the stuff her husband is, so it's kind of the source.
She was not going to turn that same look inward and look at all those places where her husband was, so she was not going to go into the basement and face it either. But that's where it lives now, and it's not going to ever leave those feelings, those emotions, that monster. But we see her go down there and feed it, and she doesn't feed it like a PBJ and some cookies. She feeds it worms.
Right. So her and Samuel are out in the garden on his birthday, digging up worms. And Samuel's like, I got a whole bunch of juicy ones here, or fresh ones. And she's like, great. And she, big old bowl.
Yeah.
And she goes down in the basement to feed the Babadook. And it comes at her. And it bends her
tries
over
to get
backwards.
In, but she fights back.
And she's like, no. And then, because she's having a good day. She's happy. Yeah. She's like, not today, fucker.
Mm-hmm.
And then, throws down some worms on a plate.
Which I thought was super important because the activities that she does with Samuel, the day-to-day stuff in life, whether it's hanging out in the garden or whatever, it's gonna produce some worms. It's gonna produce some off products. If you have depression, you're gonna find little things through that day that have eaten holes in your day. No matter how great your day was, there are gonna be problems that have stuck with you or even manifested from you in some cases that erode that day. And she is okay with letting her monster, her depression, have those things. You can have those, but you can't take what you were taking before, which was everything. You can't have me and my kids time. You can't have his birthday anymore. You can't have,
have our happiness. You can't have our life. Right.
All you get is the basement.
I thought it was really cool, the ending, because it as a horror flick, you're like, that is bizarre. What the hell just happened?
Yeah, and I loved the film the first time I saw it, and honestly, like you've already said, we walked out of there going, this was a great horror flick. I thought not a stitch of anything else we've talked about tonight.
Yeah.
Until I watched it actually later with Deanne, and she dropped a dose of reality on me about halfway through the movie, just because I wanted to share with her a great horror movie.
That was great. I see what you did there.
Right? And about halfway through the film, she goes, this is just about this lady's depression. And I swear to God, we like paused the movie and just talked about it for like 20
Mind
minutes.
Blown. Yeah.
It was so...
This ending has generated a lot of thoughts from people and interpreting them. And that's, I think, one of the joys that I have second time around is like watching and going, okay, I wonder what that means. And then reading reviews or talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
There was one that I read, which it might be a little out there, but the guy said that basically there's a quote from Shakespeare's Henry VI that is, even a worm will turn on you. And the idea behind that was that no matter how weak and how soft and how vulnerable you are, you can only take so much before you then become something greater.
Okay.
And I thought that was also a pretty cool representation of what that could be. I was like, yeah, I'll buy that.
Yeah, for sure. It's just all around a great film. Because, and again, I keep coming back to how much I loved it, even when I just saw it. Without seeing any of this stuff, I really wanted to share it. I wanted to watch it again. I wanted to go explore it again. And now, I think I've watched it another 3-4 times since then to look at all of this side of it. And it wasn't until this last viewing, which was probably viewing 4 or 5, that I noticed the similarities between Sam and the monster and how they seem to be feeding information back and forth to each other to create their own kind of shared treachery in their home and things. And you know, I wonder when I'll see it next time.
Yeah, no, it's a winner. It's up there in my top 5 easily.
Okay.
Easily. Because yeah, it's one of my favorites. Yeah, it's what it does that makes it so great for me is what it doesn't do. Mm-hmm. And that may sound very I don't know, esoteric or whatever, but it,
you know what you sound like? You sound like the Sphinx on Mystery Men. What it does the best is what it fails to do at all.
Oh dear God, I want every single one of those quotes memorized.
That'd be great.
That's fucking brilliant.
That really would be good.
But no, it's super simple, but one of the most complex movies that you'll ever watch. Like, it's crazy.
For sure. And it might still not be your cup of tea. Maybe you're like, I don't feel like going down the rabbit hole into some lady's depression. Like, that's not my jam.
If you sat me in front of the Lifetime channel, I would have said, fuck you.
Yeah. No matter how well-crafted it was. Yeah, not interested. So it's still got to be your cup of tea. But what we're hoping is that if it wasn't the first time around, listen to this. Or go, you know, watch the bonus stuff that you can watch on YouTube for free and hear Miss Kent talk about it and why she wrote it and kind of the things that she was hoping people would pick up on this. And she's very crafty when she speaks about it. I mean, we've already gone 9 levels deeper than she ever talks about.
We fully destroyed this, so I apologize if you haven't actually watched it and we just spoiled the shit out of it. But we weren't.
But I don't think we have, though. No. I think for a lot of people, you can now go back and watch it and maybe take something that one of us said and go, oh, I didn't catch that last time. Or you can look at it and go, I like it better as a boogeyman.
Yeah, I may not have.
Or you can watch it and say, those guys are a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, that kid is really annoying.
I may not have watched it again and gotten this out of it if I hadn't been turned on to the fact that, no, it's a story about real life.
Yeah.
Because then it's like, what?
Because there's a lot of moments. If you take it just as a boogeyman film, and I don't know why these moments didn't get me when I first saw it and took it as a boogeyman film, but there's a lot of moments that are just a tad cheesy, just a tad cliche. Mm-hmm. And now I see that that's all on purpose, that that's all just to say, well, that's how you manifest things. You manifest things into your lowest common denominator and whatever's the most familiar. And so if you've seen boogeyman movies and that's the way your psyche is processing things, you're going to process it like a boogeyman movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, geez, everything that they lay out, it comes to fruition.
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There's a lot here.
Don't listen to us, man. Go see it.
Yeah. Watch it again. Watch it again and then watch it one more time.
Also, drink some Dark Truth because it's really good. I'm sad it's empty.
Drink some Dark Truth. Yeah, we need more. Well, we have to go so we can go buy
drink some more.
Find some more
Dark Truth. But we've got some fun stuff coming up. We've got some fun things planned for the Halloween season. So we're going to have a little bit different take on our Halloween episode, I think. And
yeah, that'll be fun.
We'll round robin that a little bit here once we turn these microphones off. But what you guys can do for us in the meantime that would really help us out, if you like what you're hearing, if you like what we're doing, go to iTunes, go to Google Play Music, find us, drop us a rating, drop us a review, subscribe. You can also check us out at our website, which is dreadfrightandbrew.com. We are on Twitter at dreadfrightbrew, and you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/dreadfrightandbrew, of course. So come check us out there, see what we're doing. If you're in the Northwest and you want to hang out with us, have a beer. I think we might have mentioned this last time. No one's taken up our offer. So
wait till after smokepocalypse, though.
Yeah, that's true. The Northwest is completely engulfed in flames as we record this.
Yeah, maybe we'll see.
Some really amazing places. But if you want to say hi, if you want to find out where we're going to be, if we're going to any fun events around, if you want to suggest a pairing or a movie we could watch, if you want to challenge us and give us a movie you don't think we can pair a beer to, whatever you want to do, hit us up. We want some feedback. We want to hear how you guys are liking this or not liking it. And we will catch you guys next time.
Yeah,
right on. Episode 4.
Sounds good. Peace.
Blue, ha, ha, ha.